It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in now on living conditions at senior living facilities in Wisconsin and the struggle to staff centers at a level to meet basic needs of residents. Call in with a question or comment about elder care, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Melanie Cairns is managing attorney at Disability Rights Wisconsin. Melanie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me to be part of this conversation today.
Good morning. And we also have Benita Matthew, who is a health and science reporter at USA Today Network covering northeastern Wisconsin. Benita, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Benita, let's start with you. And your reporting, residents of assisted living facilities near Green Bay have spoken to you about long delays in care. What are they telling you?
Yeah, so staffing has been a problem for a while at assisted living and nursing homes around the state. But recently, just with things that have been going on since the pandemic, people have been telling me that it's really been affecting their care, you know, affecting how they're getting their everyday care, from showering to getting help getting out of bed, to getting their meds on time. There's been a few issues at some facilities.
How low is low? How low are staffing levels at the facilities you've examined?
So it kind of varies, but it's really declined at some facilities. You know, for example, one facility that I was reporting on, actually, they didn't have any trained staff to provide any medication sometimes during night shifts. And so many residents were going without their medications throughout the entire night.
And then they, during the day, they're just in catch-up mode on these meds. Is that right?
Yes.
Melanie, what type of complaints is Disability Rights Wisconsin, your organization, hearing about caregiver shortages in Wisconsin?
Sure. Thanks for that question. And I do want to applaud both Benita and you for addressing this important issue related to the severe shortage of direct support professionals in residential facilities that serve seniors. But I want to make sure I also expand the conversation to say that sadly, the problems related to the severe shortage of direct support professionals or caregivers is not isolated to assisted living facilities that serve seniors. Both seniors and younger people with disabilities are truly facing a crisis in finding qualified direct caregivers to provide the assistance they need to live and work, attend school, and basically just exist in all settings. So this includes nursing homes and assisted living facilities, but we also see this serious impact on individuals who live in smaller group homes or independent settings and rely on home or community-based caregivers that provide services such as personal care, supportive home care, or home health care. So
thank you for making that distinction. Absolutely. Go ahead.
Sure. So just to give an overview of the types of problems that we hear about, and we hear about this every week from people with all types of disabilities in every region of the state. We hear about individuals who are medically ready to discharge from a hospital, but unable to discharge due to lack of open beds in a skilled nursing facility or rehab facility, or no open beds in the region where they want to be, or no open bed that can meet their medical needs. We have observed an increase in both the number and severity of deficiencies we see in both skilled nursing facilities and assisted living facilities. And many of those involve resident abuse, neglect, serious rights violations, and we see these being directly related to staffing shortages. So things like Benita was saying, delays in administering medications, but also delays or lack of receiving assistance with activities of daily living, such as reduced access to showering, to toileting, meals being delayed, delayed assistance with repositioning or transferring, for example, from bed to wheelchair. delayed responses to call lights, reduced access to therapeutic care, such as physical therapy or occupational therapy. And we also see a lot of people who are stuck in a more restrictive setting type than what they need. So people who are sort of stuck in a skilled nursing facility or an assisted living facility and unable to move back to a more independent environment, such as, their own home or a small group home or their own apartment, because there is a delay in getting in-home equipment and in-home care workers.
I think what you're laying out here is that facility staffing levels or direct support professionals, is directly tied to outcomes and health and well-being of residents and quality of life, and in circumstances perhaps life-threatening. How do you see those connections?
Absolutely. We hear reports about individuals with serious disabilities who, because there are no caregivers to come in and provide help with those basic needs, helping people eat, helping them transfer from bed to wheelchair, helping that, providing transportation in the community, help with grocery shopping and household chores, medication administration, and healthcare needs at home, that we get calls where people are told, "Well, my worker didn't show up, and the only option I was given was to call 911, for example, or the only option I was given was I need to move to a nursing home or I need to go to the hospital."
Melanie Cairns, managing attorney at Disability Rights Wisconsin. We have Benita Matthew as well, health and science reporter at USA Today Network, as we look at the quality of care at senior and assisted living facilities and staffing levels with direct support professionals. You can join in the conversation. Call in with a question, a comment, 800-642-1234. Benita, turning back to your reporting, you reported out the story of 91-year-old Shirley Holtz, and Shirley had dementia, was dismissed from a facility after being there for 5 years. Why was that?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So Shirley lived at Emerald Bay Retirement Community, and earlier this year in February, 15 residents, including Shirley, were told that they would no longer be able to live there because they were all on Medicaid, which means that Medicaid was reimbursing their costs for living at the facility. And because of inflation and rising costs, the provider said that it was no longer feasible to, keep letting them stay there, and so they had to find new homes. And so unfortunately, that meant that they only had about a month to find a new home.
And so, in terms of moving from one facility to another, you talked a little bit about transfer trauma. What happens there?
So Shirley actually found a new home close to the Green Bay area, and what actually ended up happening was her family started noticing a lot of changes and different moods she was having in the first few weeks after she moved. They noticed that she started kind of losing weight, and she stopped eating, and she wouldn't really drink her water. And eventually, actually, sadly, she did end up passing away, and her family say it was a result of what you mentioned, transfer trauma, because of just the stress and the anxiety of finding her new home. It really affected her health, which actually, when I talk to a lot of advocates, they say it is kind of a common thing when they have to relocate, even if it's relocating to another room in the same facility. But in this case, Shirley had a lot of changes that really impacted her.
And you said it was a matter of just several weeks where the decline was so rapid after the transfer to a new home.
Yeah, it only, I think, within 3 weeks of her moving, Shirley ended up passing away, unfortunately.
You mentioned the state's Medicaid program that's created for elderly and adults with disabilities, family care. It's called. Are facilities struggling to keep up with rising costs and what family care pays out?
Yeah, so some advocates I've talked to have said that it's been a trend that they've been noticing that just the way that family care works is that recently the Medicaid reimbursements for providers has just been too low sometimes. So that means that it's not really financially affordable for providers to retain their Medicaid residents. And so sometimes in this case of Shirley, there are some providers who just have to relocate their residents.
Benita Matthew is health and science reporter at USA Today Network covering northeastern Wisconsin. Melanie Cairns, managing attorney at Disability Rights Wisconsin, that's a nonprofit advocacy organization. You can join the conversation about elder care. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We discuss services at senior living facilities and in-home care and how staffing shortages are affecting Wisconsin's aging adults. As complaints to the state health department are rising to numbers not seen in recent years, that reporting from Benita Matthew, a USA Today Network health and science reporter who stays with us. And Melanie Cairns is here, managing attorney at Disability Rights Wisconsin. You can add your comments to the discussion. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Nancy in Madison. Nancy, hi.
Yes, good morning. I'm a member of NAMI, and I am wondering whether we'd have an improvement in the situations that are being discussed if the state of Wisconsin legislature would permit our taking Medicaid expansion. What effect might that have or not have?
Nancy, thank you for that question. Melanie, go ahead.
Well, thanks for that that very important question, Nancy. That is not something I came prepared to speak about today because we were focused more on the direct caregiver crisis. But the basic answer to the question is that if Wisconsin were to expand Medicaid, we believe that Medicaid services would be improved, including the services we're talking about today.
Do you think, Benita, as well, from your reporting and people you talked with, that it would make a difference in direct care to residents if Medicaid expansion happened in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so I agree with Melanie. I would have to do more reporting on that to answer that more specifically. But generally, when I have talked to people in different associations, they have said that an increase in funding would certainly benefit residents and really impact their care on that level.
Melanie, what happens when someone who needs care at a facility is dismissed? We've also heard it as an eviction as well. Go. What do you see happening there?
Sure. So just to provide a bit of background, in Wisconsin, there are a variety of residential setting types with different licensing and certification standards. So we have nursing homes or skilled nursing facilities, and then we have assisted living facilities, which include community-based residential facilities and 3 and 4 bed adult family homes and residential care apartment complexes or RCACs. And each one of those, and then we also have what are called certified 1 and 2 bed adult family homes. And each one of those setting types has their own rules for what type of notice the individual needs to receive, like what type of notice the facility needs to provide before a resident can be involuntarily discharged, as well as the reasons that a resident can be involuntarily discharged.
And they have to be able to go you know, when it is a dismissal, if I understand if it takes more time to find a new place, it is a decision that the family and the care facility and the resident has to come together on an agreement. Is there more flexibility in the time it takes to be able to find that new facility?
That's a bit of a difficult question for me to ask, for me to answer, because services in Wisconsin, you know, for all people should be individualized and person-centered, you know, yeah, focused on the person's needs and the person's individual choices about where they want to live. So yes, that is the process that is supposed to happen when an individual either wishes to move from one place to another or is sort of forced to move with not as a result of their choice. There is supposed to be a process in which the important people to, you know, get together and have a conversation about what the individual is looking for in their next living facility. Unfortunately, due to the types of problems we're talking about with facilities closing on short notice, without the time it takes to really build a good have a good plan for transition to a new facility, that does result in the transfer trauma that Benita was speaking about, because people end up needing to being told, for example, there are no open beds in the county in which you want to live, or this is it, you know, you need to take this sight unseen, because that's the only place that will take you. We've heard stories about individuals who were, the one facility they were living in was closing. They needed to find a new facility, and their managed care organization or health insurance company or case manager contacted, you know, dozens or even over 100 facilities before being able to find one that had an open bed.
Melanie Cairns with us, managing attorney at Disability Rights Wisconsin. Benita Matthew, health and science reporter at USA Today Network. Benita, in May, the state health department extended this ban on admissions to a Green Bay facility after two residents had died from unexplained injuries that were not investigated by the provider. And the owner of the facility is appealing that decision. How has the department responded to deaths at assisted living facilities throughout the state?
So at Reflections in Green Bay that you're referring to, they did appeal, and DHS came back with a decision to lift the ban to allow them to take on new residents, and found that the two people who were injured, their injuries were not actually the cause of their death. So in this case, it is a little bit different because they did appeal and found different findings. But yeah, I think it just depends on the severity of the investigations that DHS does, that kind of determines what they find.
And you've been reporting, there's this ongoing backlog of inspections at facilities. How severe is this backlog?
So currently DHS doesn't have a backlog for any of the complaints that have come in to their highest level, because they conduct their investigations based on the level of severity that the complaints shows at the facility. But yeah, currently there are complaints coming in, and there are a few complaints that are listed as overdue, which means that they still have to do an investigation and have inspectors come into the facility to check the place out. So there is still currently an ongoing list of things to look into.
Let's go to Monica in Sheboygan. Monica, what comes up for you?
Hello?
Hi, Monica. We can hear you. Go ahead.
Hi, I am aware of the shortages of caregivers in all areas, and I'm so glad you're reporting this so that the that America starts becoming more aware of this. But my question is, what are we doing to actively appease this? What, how can we get this rectified? And one thought that I have is immigration. Is there anything...
And Monica, we're short on time. I just want to toss this to Melanie here quickly as we start to wrap up. Go ahead, Melanie, on what is moving right now.
Sure, I'll do my best to answer that question briefly. Disability Rights Wisconsin, both independently and as a partner of the Wisconsin Survival Coalition, supported and recommended a number of provisions in the most recent state budget that would have simultaneously improved wages and benefits and work conditions for direct support professionals in all areas, as well as provided additional resources to the Department of Health Services Division of Quality Assurance to address, you know, that backlog and their ability to better investigate these allegations and concerns about abuse and neglect.
We have to stop it there, but thank you both for joining us. Melanie Cairns, Managing Attorney at Disability Rights Wisconsin. Benita Matthew, Health and Science Reporter at USA Today Network, covering Northeastern Wisconsin. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
She's a deep blue sea, makes her cry out in despair when she gets a hold of me. Water, give me water, so that I can help until I reach the sun.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This song is called The Anima, from Milwaukee area musician Culla. Newest album is called Firebird. It's the 16th, and it was named the most unique album of the year by the Wisconsin Area Music Industry Awards. Call in with a question, share a comment along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ian McCullough, also known as Culla, is a multidisciplinary artist, songwriter, computer engineer, and entrepreneur. Culla, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Really happy to be here.
Well, take us into The Anima and what you appreciate about this song.
Sure, yeah. The Anima comes from Jungian psychology. Mm. It's the divine feminine in the masculine, kind of like the yin and the yang. And it's very much about Carl Jung's concept of the maturation of the anima in a man. And Sophia, which is the chorus of that song, is the highest level of maturity of the concept, the conceptual nature of feminine in masculine. Like Sophia is the second half of philosophy, philos Sophia, the love of divine knowledge.
How did it come to you in song, in verse?
Well, it just came. You know, got that nice blues guitar tone, and I had been thinking about it for a while, and try not to think too hard about channeling some of that type of creativity in songs, but had some intention to discover pieces of that and explore how to do that. But
do you explore psychology, and or was this kind of a one-off theme for a song that it would dig deep into psychology?
No, I've been exploring particularly Jungian psychology in song for the past few years, at least probably since 2019, more intentionally. It's I find as an artist, it is rich with lots of good maps of how to make meaning out of things, which is very useful as a storyteller and a songwriter to have some clear mapping of what is what, and gives lots of images and clear direction.
We could use some clear mapping today in this world, right? You know, you're unique, according to the Wisconsin Area Music Industry Awards, your newest album, Firebird, a unique album of the year. Why do you imagine people perceive your music as unique?
Well, I believe it's unique, or they've labeled it as unique and voted it in as unique, because that album in particular, which isn't uncommon amongst the rest of my albums, but each song has a different style, mood, and genre that almost are very disparate of each other in relation with each other. So the anima here is kind of more of a blues gospel song, but the other songs, there's a bluegrass song, there's a neo soul hip hop spoken word song, and then there's also a more electronic operatic song called The Feather. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just a seemingly disparate styles that come together. And I think that's what makes it unique, blending of the different styles that might not necessarily be bedfellows, but here they are.
How does your computer engineering degree and your media technology degree background fold into your music? How does that technical side influence what comes out of you in these albums?
Yeah, I've since I was very little, I've been very interested in the convergence between technology and creativity. My father was a computer scientist and would bring home lots of different pieces of electronic equipment to build computers and peripherals and accessories for computers. And so I explored that and just explored software at an early age alongside exploring music. And so to me, they were very much almost the same type of creative expression and etude of exploring these different things. And so it's more natural to me, but I think in the age of the democratization of sound, is what we refer to it at when we have integrated circuits and little microcontrollers that are cheap and accessible at a consumer level, we now have the ability to compose using these technologies and kind of maybe skip some of those rigorous academic and challenging steps of notation and synthesis and recording, these things that would take large amounts of budgets and expertise perhaps 50 to 100 years ago. But now they're just at our fingertips, a few clicks here and there, and you can whir up some sounds and synthesize. And so I've always just explored it because it's quite accessible.
It seems to me when you talk about disparate, you know, you've got your love of the piano, which is like super low tech if you don't, you know, if it's not like a keyboard, but, you know, the piano, and then you've got all of these circuitries and the software side of things, and somehow it you put all that together. And that to me must be really interesting for you because you appreciate both so much.
Yeah, well, the piano is quite an engineering feat itself.
yes.
If you look at it and actually, if anyone's ever looked inside a piano and look at it and say, what the heck is going on in there? To your point, yeah, then to convert that mechanism of pianos is quite very, very interesting and powerful mechanism. Now then to interface it with digital technology and to be able to trigger different pieces of software. And now we have artificial intelligence and stuff, which is a whole nother beast. But yeah, I find it very kind of the similar. To me, they're the same in a lot of ways. I find many people see that as conflicting, or perhaps things that are that don't mix well, creativity and logic or things of that nature, like you're kind of alluding to. But to me, I find them as the same. I get the same feeling when you create a piece of software that someone can utilize. I get the same sense of satisfaction and perhaps pride in a way where someone is utilizing this creation of mine. It gets to become alive and grows bigger than your initial intention. I find that to be a similar feeling than when I create a song.
talking with Milwaukee area musician Kulla as part of a series of conversations with Wisconsin musicians, and you can join in the conversation as well at 800-642-1234. You've released albums annually, apparently on your birthday, April 27th, and we're going to hear another song from Firebird. This one is titled The King.
I'm a soldier of fortune, incredibly. I'm the luckiest man I've ever seen. Soon enough, my luck will change, and I lose my grip on my reins to my brain. Dive into the world beyond. That's reality, a travesty, you don't say. A full of pity stood up to me, saw the part of him retire. Always caused his nights to light up, sitting by the fire and brimstone.
So what is the inspiration for this song, The King?
Well, it's in the album Firebird, which is wholly inspired by the Slavic myth of Ivan and the Firebird. Hmm. And that track, The King, refers to kind of the end of a hero's journey, when the hero becomes king. A lot of people know that of the hero's journey, or perhaps have heard of heard of hero. And hero is actually an immature archetype in psychology, where they are on their journey to become fully mature, and the king is that. And so this song, actually, I knew that I wanted to come up with this kingly experience and transformation in this album. So I looked back in some of my old songs that I had never released, and I ended up finding this song called Usurper of the Throne that I had made 12 years ago. And I recreated it with some great musicians here in Milwaukee and kind of changed it a little bit here and there. But those words are really the words of me over a decade ago, looking forward as where could I be as in my transformation and in my maturation. So it's a very interesting thing when I hear it, and when I experience the meaning and intention of that, is because it's all about the maturation and the grabbing or the transforming of power into something more mature. But yet it's through the lens of an immature.
Oh, well, thank you for that. Let's go to Lisa in Milwaukee. Lisa, hi.
Hi, good morning. Hey, I was, I'm curious about your music, and now you're talking about a king. I was just thinking, there's a Bible story about a king called King David, and he used to play his harp for Saul, who was also a king before David was, but it used to calm his soul. Is that something your music could do for people, calm their soul?
First of all, Lisa, thank you for your comment and for the reference into the King David and the harp, because that's a beautiful story. And as far as calming the soul, that's something that I've intentionally made in my music since the beginning, for 16 years. The first 5-6 years I would make the music just to calm my own soul, truly, and I wouldn't release it or even share it with anyone, but then I would start to release them, and then I would get great feedback from people that would tell me incredible experiences that they would have about how the music made them feel and how it would get them through very hard times, sometimes quite graphic and very uncomfortable times that they're describing to me. So I truly believe that that is a part of my vocation and my mission here in this world, is to use music to express some of these stories and these feelings to calm or give some sense of solace in the woe.
McCullough is a Milwaukee area musician and entrepreneur. This is The Golden Apple as we explore the wide-ranging sounds from Wisconsin's music scene. And you can be part of the discussion with a question at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
I can bite you on your arm.
It tastes delicious.
Like a flush red apple skin. I know you don't mean harm.
You seem suspicious.
But your smile is quite enchanting. A thread of your hair sewn with your needle stare and a rhinestone glare. A wave of fiery love taking full control and swallowed me whole. Stop.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is I Don't Mind It from the 2019 album Spectacula by Cullough, recognized by the Wisconsin Area Music Industry Awards for the uniqueness of his most recent album. Also a nationally touring musician. Share your thoughts about music. Call in with a question at 800-642-1234. Cullough, we heard from Stan, who sent in a question asking you, where is your favorite place to record music?
That's a great question. Yeah, I say the favorite, my most favorite place that I've recorded in has been in a shack up in near Wausau in a place called Athens, Wisconsin, where there's no internet, there's no service for your cell phone. It's just you in the calmness of the beautiful nature of Wisconsin. I find that to be some of the best places and moments to channel the creativity and to channel the inspiration from all the amazing and beautiful natural things that Wisconsin has to offer.
You've also been compared to Beck, the musician, the Beck of Milwaukee, as some people say. How does that feel to you?
I mean, I love Beck. so I definitely take that as a compliment. And I've grew up listening to him. So It is, you know, it's I'll leave the comparisons to everyone else, but I take that as a compliment.
You've released 16 albums as open source material, music free for non-commercial uses. Why is that important to you?
Yeah, I think alluding a little bit back to the previous conversation, just what we talked about with how the synthesizer and how the democratization of sound has occurred because of it, I think the internet and the distribution that comes with that brings completely different forcing functions for marketplace dynamics and value exchange. And I think that when it comes to releasing things as non-commercial, I grew up on the internet at the early stages of it. I remember dialing up very young and music is quite ubiquitous now with streaming. So to me, I felt in two things. One, I felt like it was the ethical and moral thing to do to share my experiences and to share everything and allow my creation to be utilized amongst anyone who wanted to. But on the other end, it's also, I think, an economic and distribution advantage, because now you're lowering the barrier of entry for folks to utilize these intellectual property and these creative works. But at the same time, you know, I feel as a musician, and I would recommend to other musicians as well, to make sure to lower the barrier of entry and not try to hold on to your things as much as possible. Just be okay with sharing it, because music is quite a cheap commodity in terms of streaming. We look at it now and most times it's free.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it made sense to not try to fight that and perhaps embrace that and try to utilize that and turn it around and give it away.
Can you make a living with that level of sharing?
Yeah, you can. So not everybody is looking for non-commercial. You talk to folks with budgets and lawyers, and they want nice licenses, and they want things on their balance sheets to be clear, and they don't mess around with certain quote unquote gray areas of legal and creative licensing, which I use Creative Commons. Mm-hmm. And it's a form of distribution. It just as you maybe people have heard of the term exposure, right? This is a thing that musicians have quite wrestle with, this term. They have love-hate relationships with exposure, because, well, exposure maybe may not get you, you know, you can't take exposure to the bank, but you can monetize exposure through many different ways. And as we see now with the internet in particular, and experiences where you have opportunities to get in front of many people, it is now, it's your responsibility as that performer or as that artist to make sure that you are able to connect with that audience and have mechanisms in place in order to monetize you from that exposure.
Talking with Milwaukee area musician Kulla as part of our series of conversations this summer with Wisconsin musicians. The number is 800-642-1234 to join in. You mentioned AI much earlier. How will artificial intelligence change the music business?
It's a great question. I don't have the crystal ball. I wish I did. It's from what I can gather, and from, because I have conversations about this quite often with folks in panels and stuff deep into new bleeding edge technology conversations with people much more qualified than myself that speak on this. There's one analogy that I've heard, which is keeps getting reused when there's new technology around, but the idea of the Gutenberg press, mm-hmm. and how that changed how we perceive writing. Whereas before the Gutenberg press, before you could copy print, it took quite a lot of effort to write the words from, you know, one to copy manuscript over, mm-hmm. manually. And the scribes at the time, you know, they would look at it and say, well, this isn't real, that you don't actually know what those words mean. I know what the meaning of is. I'm writing the words physically, this physical act. So you could find analogy in that, where now we have just a new tool that can give more power towards someone who has a sense of creativity. Just like I mentioned about the democratization of sound, where you have a synthesizer, where I can have a keyboard, mm-hmm. that's plugged into my computer and have access to an orchestra. Now, perhaps you could just tell it a couple things just from a prompt.
There's a song somewhere in there. Fascinating discussion. Thank you for joining us, Kulla.
Thanks so much, Kate. I'm so happy to be here.
Kulla, Milwaukee area musician, entrepreneur, newest album, Firebird. This is Raining Fire from his 2009 album. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.